8. In flight. I have to admit that I was surprised that McAfee had opened up so much about the thing, McAfee Antivirus, that he was arguably most famous for and to which his name will forever be attached. I had always been under the impression that he viewed this part of his life as the least interesting. But what I realized was that it arguably was the part that was least interesting. He was, however, perfectly happy to lay it all out for me in terms of how it informed everything he did thereafter. For him, McAfee wasn't so much of a culmination of a career as it was the beginning of a totally new life. While nobody would ever say that the first 40 years of John McAfee's life were pedestrian by any normal standards, relative to what would follow, they certainly were. Regardless, I sensed that he felt relief that he'd talked about the McAfee years and was now out the other side of those conversations. Work to him was always something that got in the way of life. And from 1994 onwards, with an estimated $100 million in the bank, John McAfee had every intention of living life to the max, come what may. John McAfee. Because I'd had no time to do anything apart from work, it was Linda who started our buying spree while I was still busy working in the final years of McAfee. There we were in this big mansion, on 3 levels, on a cliff overlooking the ocean in Santa Cruz. We had paid $4 million for it, and it was the most expensive house in Santa Cruz County at that time. There were 7 bedrooms and a staff house with 3 more bedrooms. We weren't going to be able to look after this place, so we started getting people, cleaners, etc., in addition to security, because now people knew who I was and might want to steal from me. Then the next thing Linda said was, "We can't live here and be driving those cars." The next thing I knew, our garage was full of expensive cars, all of them Mercedes. We had almost every model, including one of the only 12 SL600s in the country at that time. We had all of that shit, and much of this had happened without any input from me. I'd been too busy working, while Linda was obviously bored and wanted to do and buy stuff. Me? Are you saying that your goals and wishes were becoming less aligned? John McAfee? Yes, I think we wanted different things. She wanted to live the life of the super rich, whereas I was doing everything I could to push away all the things that people think are necessary to support a super rich lifestyle. I went to no parties, even though I was inevitably invited everywhere. I just had no time for that lifestyle. That lifestyle was all she wanted. We were misaligned. Things were going bad. I remember one year shortly before I quit working, I can't remember which, when I decided to buy her a brand new Porsche Boxster convertible as a surprise birthday present. I test drove all of them, and that motherfucker was the most fun. It was the best car I'd ever driven, albeit that it was the cheapest model in the Porsche range at the time. On her birthday, this car was delivered to the driveway from a flatbed transporter wrapped in ribbon with a bow. As it was being lowered to the ground, she turned to me and said, "But that's the cheapest model." That was her first comment. And thereafter, she never drove it, which for me was the best deal in the world because I had a lot of fun taking that sucker out. Me, what happened when you actually stopped working? John McAfee, we had cash in the bank and 3 times as much out there being invested on our behalf. Because Linda had handled all the finances, I had never really paid attention to what we had and where it was. But when I stopped working and finally took a moment to look around and assess where I was positioned, I was very happy to have a super-rich lifestyle from a financial standpoint without having to live the typical social lifestyle required to partner it. I think I'm one of the few people who managed to become super-rich and then stop. Can you imagine Bill Gates just walking away when Microsoft was about to explode? Or Richard Branson bailing when Virgin was about to shoot off? Shit no, they kept working harder. And they did so because they only ever did it for the money, whereas I didn't. Don't get me wrong, I didn't want to give any of it back, but it wasn't my goal to get it in the first place. It just came to me. To that extent, I was unique, and for me, this was the beginning of a new life instead of me feeling like I was retiring. Although I had never really worked in the past, I did at least have to stay in the same city for the duration of each job, and I even pushed the boundaries of that as far as I could. But now I had no ties at all, and more money than I could ever spend. Me? So, with all of the above in mind, what did you do? John McAfee? I wasn't exactly happy with Linda, but I knew that if I was to divorce her, I'd most likely be tied up in court for 1.5 years. The financial implications didn't concern me. I just didn't want to waste time that I could better use doing something more fun. So I decided to just live with her, and to that extent, I set her down and said, "Now listen, you know that I love you dearly and that you'll get half of everything, but I can't live with you permanently anymore. I just can't do it." So I took our first Mercedes convertible and our dog, Red, and went to Colorado to a house I'd recently started building on the proviso that I'd return to California every 2 weeks. Me? How was she about all this? John McAfee? Initially, she was fine with the arrangement, and in any case, I was trying to accommodate her wishes because by this time, she was quite happy in this high-flying company she'd been keeping. She liked rubbing shoulders with the super rich and going to so-called charity fundraisers, and when I was back, I'd put on a tuxedo and go with her now and again. But it just wasn't for me. I despised these charity events and saw them only as scams to put more money in the pockets of people who didn't have a clever enough idea of their own to create something. After a year or so of going back and forth between Colorado and Santa Cruz, I sat her down again and said, "Linda, I can't spend a whole week here once a month. How about I come home for just a weekend every 2 weeks?" Again, she agreed to that, and that arrangement, in theory, continued until 2004, when we eventually got divorced. It became absurd beyond belief. Everybody knew we weren't a couple. Jesus, I was in newspapers with other women in various parts of the world. Me? What exactly were you doing in Colorado? John McAfee? I built this mansion in the mountains of Colorado on 400 acres, 10 miles from the nearest small town, Woodland Park, and 40 miles from Colorado Springs. In the winter, I was completely cut off. The house was at an elevation of 10,000 feet at the foot of the Rockies. No town or county was going to come out and clear the access roads. So I needed snowblowers, snowplows, tractors, forklifts, and generators to clear the roads and to create my own power if I had to. I had a whole hangar full of vehicles for various uses on this remote, beautiful property. I stayed in that house for longer than any other. Although I travelled extensively, I was there for 11 years. I was blissfully happy there. Me? When and how did you build this property? John McAfee? I started it during the last years of working at McAfee, and it was as much about the act of building it as it was about actually living there. The whole project took 5 years, but when I started going down there at that time, when I was going back and forth to California, only the first 2,500 square feet was finished. But it was livable, just for me. And then, while I was living there, it was expanded to the west to include a Frank Lloyd Wright-inspired section. I basically borrowed the block style from his Ennis house in Los Angeles, except that where he had the block constructed by pouring concrete, I had it hand-carved out of sandstone. The edges were crisp and sharp, with none of that concrete bubble. The block alone cost me $7 million, including all the imported artwork that went in it. The entire build process for the mansion cost me in the vicinity of $20 million. Not that I ever really ever kept track of anything I spent. Me? Why not? That sounds crassly irresponsible. John McAfee? There comes a point where, if you have enough money and investments working for you, you just can't spend it all. I don't say this to belittle the amounts involved or to come across as blasé, but it's just a fact. While I was spending $20 million on a property in Colorado, the interest alone being earned on my money was far in excess of that amount. A money manager was taking care of all that. That's what happens when you reach a certain level of wealth. And it wasn't just the property I built at Woodland Park. I built a horse farm for 6 horses, 6 cabins, 2 yoga centers, one of which was 6,000 square feet, and a giant shed for all the gear. I had a permanent live-in staff of 7 people. It was a colossal undertaking from a maintenance standpoint alone. There were 6,000 electrical outlets with bulbs that needed changing. Me? What was the attraction of the wilderness kind of lifestyle? It's the diametric opposite of Silicon Valley. John McAfee? Subconsciously, that was probably the point. Initially, I liked the isolation. I spent most of my time outside, undertaking maintenance work on the property and doing some serious hiking. In the dark winter months, I started lifting weights, writing, and then I started a yoga center and began hosting bespoke yoga retreats. I had thousands of people come through, and most of them I didn't even bother charging. They came, we fed them, and we housed them in cottages on the property for weeks on end. Some never left. Quite a few never left. My staff numbers gradually started growing. One part of me was saying, "What the fuck? The other half of me was saying, I can't just kick these people out. Me, if I'm being honest, this sounds more like a cult. What did you know about yoga? John McAfee, I can see why. But it really wasn't. It did, however, continue for 3 years or so. Since a couple of brief trips to India and Nepal in my late 20s that I neglected to mention, I'd always had an interest in yoga and meditation. In Delhi, I learned about transcendental meditation with the Maharishi, the founding yogi of that technique. I discovered yoga, breathwork, and meditation. It was exhausting and also enlightening. When I came back, my hair was shoulder length and I had cultivated a goatee beard. I was a proto-hippie, just respectable enough to keep getting jobs in technology and just cool enough to mix it with any sort of hippie crew. When the Maharishi started his movement across the US in the late 70s, I continued dabbling, depending on where I was living, working at that time. Me. I've been talking to you long enough and think I know you well enough to call you out here. This yoga center concept, in combination with people staying on the property permanently, doesn't make any sense. What was the deal? John McAfee. Okay, let me be honest here. The real reason I started the yoga retreat was to get women. And given that it was mostly women who were interested in yoga retreats, it seemed like a logical way. Not just that, because they were interested in doing yoga, chances are they were bright, healthy, and in good shape. Me, I have to say this sounds like cynical behavior at best. John McAfee. What was the alternative? The nearest town had a gas station, two restaurants, a bank, and a small rodeo arena. There were certainly no young women that I'd have been interested in there, and I wasn't exactly going to drive 40 miles to Colorado Springs just to get laid. I was 200 miles away from fucking Denver, so I thought, I'll just bring them here. That solves all my pussy problems. And so that was the plan. Inevitably, the ones who stayed were the women. It inevitably became a bit of a sex paradise at the beginning. But once I'd been doing this for a couple of years, with two or three new ones staying on each visit, the social tension among these women became palpable. When we were doing yoga, just the girls and me, you could slice the tension in that fucking room with a knife. Me, it's not exactly polygamy, but it sounds a bit like it. John McAfee, I need to make it clear, this was not a scam. I had been to India and meditated with the Maharishi. I could teach yoga and had studied it for years. I could do any pose. When people came, they learned. But I didn't do it all out of the kindness of my heart to spread love and peace, nor was I doing it because I enjoyed yoga that much myself. As much as I was a master of it, there were plenty of other things I'd have rather been doing. No, I did it for one reason and one reason only, to fuck many women without ever having to leave my property. But after a while, I sensed that familiar feeling of impending doom. I had to shut the whole thing down. I could see that I was creating a potentially uncontrollable monster right on my own doorstep. My yoga retreat succeeded and failed simultaneously, and in the long run, the whole thing probably cost me $1 million all told, given that I had to feed all these people, etc. There was no investment lost. I still owned everything after the people left. I wrote 4 books on yoga in the long winter months. However, the local town of Woodland Park did benefit from my running these retreats. Several people moved there from other areas. It is one of the most beautiful places, right on the slopes of the Rocky Mountains, with uninterrupted views of Pike's Peak, all 14,115 feet of it. Me, why did you write those yoga books and then publicly trash them? John McAfee. Because they were nothing but naive garbage. They weren't inaccurate per se, but the only one I read after it was published, Into the Heart of Truth, confused even me. As I read it, I was thinking, what's he talking about? Me, sure, but you wrote them and must have thought they were worthy at the time. Why the need to actively distance yourself from them and sabotage sales? John McAfee, I probably did think they were serviceable at the time, and in any case, I only wrote them to fill my evenings when it was dark at 5 p.m. and there was nothing else going on. I didn't have cable, and I got tired of watching movies, so I just cranked 4 books out one after another. But I later criticized them because I didn't want people to read them. I was embarrassed to have written them, and to have regurgitated so much of what I'd read so many times over the years. What does it matter? Me, it matters because it makes you look impulsive and unpredictable. And apart from anything else, what will you later say about this book? John McAfee, I am impulsive and unpredictable. So it wasn't as if my criticizing these books should have come as a surprise to anyone. With this book, I trust you to portray me fairly. Me, Did any of the women you met at the yoga retreat stay in your life afterward? John McAfee. Yes, actually. Jennifer, her name was. She came for one of the courses and just stayed. She became my girlfriend, and by 2002, I had divorced Linda because she wanted to go off and remarry, which I was perfectly fine with. Me. When did you get started on the whole idea of aero-trekking sport flying? John McAfee. After the yoga center closed down, I found myself looking out of the window, admiring what was around me. The house was finished as a place like that was ever likely to be, and the views to Pike's Peak were just breathtaking. I had various women friends who liked to come and go hiking with Jennifer and me, one of whom was Grace Jones's sister Pam, who lived in Colorado Springs at the time. She would come up with her friend and they'd hike, maybe spend the night. It was all just fine. Then I thought to myself, what could I do to broaden the experience of this place? I desperately wanted to do something beyond just appealing to various parasitic friends who wanted to come in from out of state and women, many of whom just wanted to move in with me. I started getting enthused by the idea of flying these micro-light type aircraft with single airplane engines, which allowed you to skim just a few feet above the ground. There was an incredible sense of freedom attached to what is called sport flying over wheat fields at a height where you could almost touch the crop with your bare feet, or flying below telephone wires at 90 miles per hour instead of above them. Sometimes I'd put a slow wing on and go up early in the morning when the air was calm and fly at 20 miles an hour. Before you know it, you are 1 mile in the air and looking at the earth from a hawk's perspective. And hawks, by the way, were my best friends. Birds in general don't like these slow wings. It freaks them out. They fly away. But hawks will seek you out. They'll soar right off your wing, looking at you as if to say, what the fuck are you? How are you even flying? Then they'll soar with you for 30 seconds and then reappear on the other wing. Now, this all might not sound so great, but sex itself doesn't sound great until you've actually done it. But believe me, sport flying was intoxicating in its appeal for me. Typical of me, I dived into this pursuit head first. Me, in what sense, what was your broader vision for where this sport could go? John McAfee. Once I realized that flying was something I wanted to do as a passion, I also acknowledged that the only suitable places that this could be safely done were in the vast expanses of wilderness in the Southwest, in states like Arizona, New Mexico, and Utah. Far away from inconveniences like highways, pylons, and electricity lines. So what I decided on was to create a network of landing strips whereby someone could fly all day over the wilderness. To do that, what I did was drive around with Jennifer in a Hummer, and we spent many weeks camping and identifying places where I could build these airstrips. For a few years, this sport consumed me. It was my whole life. I had 2 airstrips at my own house and a hangar full of planes. I ended up getting 4 out of the 10 I'd planned built, and then my nephew Joel died. And when that happened, I canned everything. Me? Was it simply an accident? John McAfee. It was. We don't even know what really happened. He was in the remote wilderness, and he had a passenger. All that we know is that they crashed into the side of a mountain and were both killed. Me? Did you blame yourself? John McAfee. Not for the crash itself. That was truly an accident. But I did have an awareness that this activity I had created with sport flying was probably one of the most inherently dangerous sports out there. Me, you had to fend off a wrongful death lawsuit, right? John McAfee. In fact, the lawyers, when they sued me, claimed that it was, statistically speaking, the most dangerous sport in the world. Maybe that was just lawyer talk, I don't know. But because I'd lost my nephew Joel, who had become kind of a son to me, even I realized that I had lost him because I had crossed the line of risk acceptability. I took risks that no sane man should have ever taken. I personally only survived because of sheer luck. I was in so many tight situations where I had no clue how I escaped, and yet I did. Joel was only 21. How could he have understood how to calculate risk? He didn't know shit about danger. He just saw me, his uncle, doing it, and so he wanted to do it too. Others wanted to continue, and I said, "Go ahead. You know what the risks are now." I left my planes there and never went back until I auctioned everything off a couple of years later. Me. Was this what made you leave for Belize? Did you flee to avoid the repercussions of the lawsuit? John McAfee. Well, I didn't leave for legal reasons. It was an indescribable tragedy to lose Joel and a wrench to have to walk away from my passion. But I wasn't wrestling with the decision or forcing myself to leave. I just knew that leaving was something that had to happen. I never wanted to deliberate about things for too long. No, in such situations I just calmly asked myself, what is it that needs to happen now? And what had to happen was for me to get a total change of perspective, because everything in Colorado, the house, the planes, etc., reminded me of Joel. I didn't leave for legal reasons. Me, was this when you went to Belize? John McAfee. Not quite. In 2006, after Joel's death, I was certainly thinking about leaving, but Jennifer and I hadn't yet decided where we wanted to go. However, I had business to attend to before I left. I had to get rid of everything in Colorado. I also had other properties scattered around that I'd either built or had built over the preceding few years. I should probably tell you about those. Me, why did you build these places in the first place? Just because you could? John McAfee, partly that, I suppose. I like the process of conceiving an idea and seeing it through. While living in Colorado, I had travelled all over the world and been inspired by different places, their architecture and their art. I enjoy sourcing materials and incorporating them all into a design that was totally unique. I just like constructing buildings to an extremely high level of quality. Some of them obviously had some kind of attraction as a place to live permanently, but inevitably, because my life is so complex and I travel around a lot, there are a few houses that I built spending many millions of dollars that I never actually lived in. One such example is a house I built in South Padre Island in Texas. Flat, hot. I have no idea why people wanted to live there, but at some point I thought I did because the fishing was good. So I built a mansion that was essentially three mansions in one, right on the ocean. And all three were three levels high and were interconnected by external stairways in the style of the Dutch artist M.C. Escher. You'd have a stairway going from level 3 of house 1 to level 2 of house 2, then another stairway from level 1 of house 2 going to level 3 of house 3, and so on. It was so confusing that people staying there would occasionally need rescuing. I only set foot in it 3 times in total. Me, you need to explain. That sounds completely ludicrous. John McAfee, I always had people project managing these builds for me. There were a few of them over the years, but the best of them was a woman called Maria, who I met with her now boyfriend at the yoga retreat in Colorado. She lived with me briefly in the house before Jennifer came on the scene. We had an affair. I loved her at the time, very smart woman. So whenever I found a location in which I wanted to build a property, the first thing I did was call Maria. And from there, she'd take over all the logistics of liaising with architects and contractors with a view to getting it built. All the time, we'd be talking on the phone and she'd be updating me on progress. And then once it was built and the house was secured and staffed, she moved on to the next place with me. Me. So you're telling me that you built this house, spent millions on it, staffed it, and then it just sat there, and you spent 3 nights in it total. That sounds implausible. John McAfee. It was possibly only 2 nights, when I think about it. When it was built, I didn't actually care for the place very much. It was a very complicated relationship I had with that house. So, yes, I was there for a couple of days, and then I decided I wanted to go and look at a piece of land in Hawaii. Now, I'd always loved Hawaii. I loved the food, the people, the culture, everything. When I was still with Linda, we regularly went there, and rather than build something in Hawaii, I leased the presidential suite at the Royal Hawaiian Hotel, the Pink Palace in Honolulu, for an entire year at a time. This would have been during the period when I was travelling back and forth from Colorado. We had all the furniture swapped out for things we liked, and then we just went down there whenever we felt like it. It was like a home away from home. And when we arrived, it was like something out of the fucking old movies, with all the hotel staff lined up outside to greet us as we got out of the limousine. Soon I knew all the staff by name, and whenever I arrived I tipped every one of them $1,000, except for the concierge, who got 5. The whole staff was my staff. I kept the lease going for several years until it became too dangerous to go to Hawaii. Me? What do you mean it became too dangerous to go to Hawaii? John McAfee? Having spent time in Hawaii, I ultimately bought 2 houses in Hawaii at various times. But the one that was problematic was in Molokai, which is a small island populated almost exclusively by natives. I had no interest in the island itself. There were no tourist services. There was nothing there for gringos whatsoever. The natives were less than friendly. We discovered Molokai on a whale-watching boat trip from Maui, and while we were out there, this pod of humpback whales appeared a mile offshore from Molokai. One of them came right up to the boat and just sat there. We could touch it. The boat captain said he'd never seen anything like it in 20 years of running whale-watching tours. That experience deeply touched me, and so I wanted to dock at Molokai to have a look around. In that moment, I thought, that was a sign. Me? So you bought a house because of that event? John McAfee. To cut a long story short, yes. We found a realtor who took us around, and we bought this beautiful property on the east end of the island, a real nice place on a cliff above the beach. I bought it from a white guy from California who built it years previously and never lived there because people just aren't welcoming to outsiders. Then I went to the west end of the island and bought 10 acres of the most dramatic piece of seascape you have ever seen, where the waves break over the volcanic rock and the spray shoots up 100 feet in the air. It was spectacular. Then began a 6-year project to build a house that I never once set foot in. Me? But you completed this place. I'm struggling to grasp the point of this on 2 levels. 1, why spend 6 years building a house in a place where you're not welcome? And 2, why build a place and never set foot in it? People will not be able to comprehend this. John McAfee. Yes, it was finished. I sold it when I went to Belize. Maria used to call me all the time and say, you've got to come and see this house. But by that time I was in Ecuador building the largest condo in the entire country. I had lost all interest in Hawaii. This would have been 2004 or 2005. Me. You said things went bad in Hawaii. In what way? John McAfee. Holy fuck, things went sideways. There are a few things out there online about it, but none of them are the truth. I liked Molokai, and I actually spent a bit of time in the first ready-built house I had bought while I was planning the build of the second one on the seascape land. But the reason I got into trouble in Molokai was that, while I was there, I realized that Molokai had one of the highest rates of methamphetamine use anywhere in America, albeit none of the natives even considered themselves to be American citizens. Seriously, I would see kids literally starving at the roadside while their parents were strung out on drugs and missing teeth, etc. It was tragic, and of course, by this time, having been clean for almost 20 years, I'd gone full circle and become something of a drug sheriff. Me, did you meddle in the workings of this island community? John McAfee, I wanted to make things better, let's put it that way. I contacted this former drug addict who was working with addicts, and I asked this guy to take me around and show me where all the meth houses were on the island. We took a professional photographer with us to document all of this. Some of these places were beside schools, others were near churches. I then took out full-page ads in Hawaii's largest newspapers and put one of these photographs alongside a headline that read something like, "This is a meth house beside a grade school. Why are you allowing this?" Well, this really embarrassed the governor, who, along with the police, chose to turn a blind eye to Molokai's drug problems, simply because it was the last remaining real native island and it was always politically sensitive to meddle in its affairs. Me. Did the embarrassment lead to action by the police and governor? John McAfee. It was all a tactical error on my behalf. I thought I was helping and being smart, but the police swooped in and flushed every fucking trace of drugs out of Molokai. Every meth house was gone within 6 months. Me. Wasn't that a good thing? John McAfee. In isolation, yes, but the drugs business brought in money. Money paid for food. Suddenly, there was none of either, and I, the gringo, was blamed for that. To say that I became a persona non grata in Molokai would be an understatement, even though the road to hell is paved with good intentions, as the saying goes. My life then took an ugly fucking turn because I needed the natives to sign the permits that would allow me to build on some sacred land on the island I'd also purchased. I'd barely squeaked by on the work I did on the existing property, and that was before I shut down the drug trade. I knew I was going to get nothing from them, so I made my next big mistake, which was to fly an American company in to auction the land off. Now that's not the sort of thing you can just do in Hawaii. I should have sensed impending doom. Natives don't view land ownership like we gringos do. To cut a long story short, it became this ugly showdown between the locals and me, and we had to bring in local riot police on the day of the auction, in addition to 5 FBI agents. Bloodshed was expected. There were 300 people there with machetes shouting, carve him up, as I stood behind a cordon of police. It ended up in a near riot. Nobody was killed, but the auction went ahead nevertheless. That was the last day I ever spent in Hawaii. I sold the first house I bought remotely years later when I was in Belize. Me: do you regret what you tried to do in Hawaii? John McAfee: I brought everything upon myself through a combination of arrogance and stupidity. I was a white man who knew jack shit about Hawaiian culture, really, even though I'd been going there for years. All I knew was the Pink Palace and that everything was plastic. In reality, I knew nothing about the culture on Molokai, the last real Hawaiian island. What the fuck was I thinking? Me: to me, there are obvious parallels between what happened in Molokai and what later happened in Belize. It's impossible for me to ignore that connection. It feels like you have a messiah complex. John McAfee: yeah, okay. I admit I have a fault. I do look at situations and think that they can be fixed. But the reality is that it's not that simple. Because if it was, none of the socio-economic problems that we have in the world today would exist. Life is just not that simple as much as I wish it was. I never learned. If someone took all the children off the earth, it would be so much easier for me. I just can't stand children suffering because their parents are whacked out on drugs. I go crazy and I do stupid shit. And what I gradually found out was that the police in these places were usually the ones benefiting most from the drug trade anyway. Me: you won't like this, but I'm going to ask you anyway. Why do you care about the children of Belize and Molokai so much when you barely have a relationship with any of your own? John McAfee: that's not the same. Me: I'd say it is. They are your kids, aren't they? John McAfee: yes, but they are not living in poverty, as far as I'm aware, and in some cases, the women whose children I had never even told me about the kids anyway, and therefore I was never involved in their lives directly after they were born. Regrettably, I do not have a very good relationship with my daughter, though. We talk, but not often. Me: why did you choose Ecuador to build? John McAfee: I'd grown tired of physically roaming around, discovering new places. I'd gotten lazy and at the same time started realizing there were internet sites available for idiots like me who were just looking for the next new and glamorous place to live or own property. I started searching for the best places to live on the planet, and I started noticing that Cuenca, Ecuador, appeared on almost every top 10 list. It was known as the City of Perpetual Spring because, although it sits directly on the equator, because it's at an elevation of 9,000 feet, the climate is perfect year-round. Nobody needed air conditioning, nobody needed heat. You didn't need jack shit. I settled on Cuenca in which to build a house in the mountains, but when I started talking to locals in the know, they told me, it'll be a 25-year process. That's just the way it works. As a compromise, I decided to build a 17-story condo in the city, which would become the most expensive building in all of Ecuador when complete. In advance, I purchased the top floor of the building for myself. I have no idea how many millions I put into all of that. Me: would I be right in saying that, as South American countries go, Ecuador would be one of the more civilized? John McAfee: there are no civilized South American countries, my friend. It is where Edward Snowden and Julian Assange wanted to go. Let's just say they will tolerate rich white men. That's the best I can say about Ecuador. But I only ever went there twice and for a total of 6 days. Meanwhile, my business advisor, Maria, was living down there. She fell in love with Cuenca and I rented her a place to live in while the condo was being built. Again, she managed the whole thing. I was still madly in love with her and in many ways I still am. Me: looking back at all this, what were you trying to achieve with all of this extravagant building? John McAfee: I saw it all like art or sculpture. I wanted to create something beautiful. The process of creating it was what I enjoyed. But did I want to live in my art? Hell no. I lived in the Colorado house, but in my eyes it was the ugliest house I ever built. Its functionality far exceeded its artistic value, albeit that when most people walked into it for the first time, they almost fainted because of the grandeur. But Colorado paled in significance relative to other places I built in Texas, Ecuador, New Mexico, Tucson, and Hawaii. So yes, it was only about the process. Once I'd built these places, my need for them disappeared. Me: at what point did you sell all your possessions in the U.S.? John McAfee: Shortly before leaving for Belize in 2008, I organized what amounted to a giant yard sale at my mansion in Colorado. Everything went in it. Houses, cabins, dozens of cars, Airstream trailers, machinery, and valuable art and decor. Every fucking thing I owned was available to be purchased and taken away. Some of it I let people take away for nothing. People came from the surrounding towns and cities and basically picked the place clean. The house itself was sold to a man from Chicago. It went for $5 million. He got a great deal. Then later, once I was in Belize, the various other houses in New Mexico, Tucson, Texas, etc. were all sold at auction also, with all the various items related to sport flying that went with them. These properties sold, but because of the 2008 financial crisis, the prices I got were far less than they might have been a few years earlier, but I honestly didn't care. By that point, I just wanted closure of everything. Joel's death had been the catalyst, and from that standpoint, selling everything was easy because pretty much everything I had in the US just reminded me of him. Beyond that, I realized that having multiple properties scattered all over the world was completely impractical. I just wanted to draw a line under everything and to make a clean start in a new place. At no point did I feel like I had lost anything. Have you ever lost someone dear to you, Mark? Someone in your family? Me. My father died 15 years ago. John McAfee. If you had the choice to give away every material possession you had in exchange for him living another 10 or 20 years, I bet you would do it, right? Me. Of course. John McAfee. That's how I felt when I got rid of everything. I just wish I could have brought Joel back in exchange.